And welcome back to Wednesday's Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman. Joseph Cooper doing really well and planning his return to WLRN. He's recovering from his back surgery, so we're happy to tell you that. Well, today we have a first on Topical Currents. We invite a guest to return, and it's about within 1 week. It's retired airline captain Bruce Bornstein. He was our guest for the second edition of our new series, All in a Day's Work, on August 12th. And he was telling us about the many aspects of the life and work of the airline pilot when the clock interrupted us. So we decided to bring Captain Bornstein back to answer the many questions we didn't get to in part one. We're ready for your questions now at 1-800-743-9576. There were many of you who were kind of left hanging last week. 1-800-743-9576. You can email us radio@WLRN.org, or you can tweet us at Topical Currents. So keep in mind that during our All in a Day's Work segments, we're looking only for questions about the work our guests are engaged in, not discussions about their organizations and their policies. So your comments along those lines are welcome at WLRN.org or on our Facebook page. So welcome, retired airline captain Bruce Bornstein.
Thank you, Bonnie. It's very nice to come back. Thank you for the invite.
Well, thanks for coming back. It's a first, as we said. So I thought we'd begin just touching on some of the info we did cover last week, just generally how long, which years you flew for a major international airline, and a bit about your early training, just starting there.
Okay. I started my flying and my training when I was about 18 years old, so that would take me back to 1974. And I was hired with my airline beginning of 1979, so about 6 years of training, non-military in my case.
Right.
And I was hired from January 79 until my early retirement in the past few years because of an injury that I received away from work.
And what year did you retire?
Actually, 2012.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic, your injury, which was, if you just want to say, it was a shoulder injury.
Oh, it was a silly little accident falling off a bicycle going nowhere.
Well, you know, when we were off the air last week, one of the things you were describing were the rigorous kind of physical tests that you have to go through. And since we're talking about your injury and how that, you know, made you unable to fly, tell us about those physicals. How often did you have to take them and at what age?
Okay. Every pilot that is a commercial pilot will have, normally every year is required the FAA to do a major medical. As we age, when I started, it was required once a year. I was 23 years old, and every other year, it would be just a little more involved with EKGs. We do audiograms. We would just do a little bit more, maybe do some blood work. When you turn 40, then it becomes necessary by law to have your medical every 6 months. And they still stay with the same regimen. Then the next year you'll do your cardiograms and the other required information that they need as far as blood work goes.
So it's every 6 months is what?
It's every 6 months for the airline transport license, which is the highest license to maintain.
Okay. And what about mental health tests? Do they give them? Do they administer them? Do they check it?
Well, it's a good question, and I've heard it before. Usually, the screening process is such that when a pilot is going to be considered to be hired with a major airline, you will have a series of interviews. The first is a preliminary, and if you're invited back, you would have normally what they call a board interview with maybe six people in attendance. One of them, or perhaps two, are doctors. One would be a psychologist or psychiatrist. In my case, it was a long time ago, but I do remember that they were present. And nothing specific was asked, but they have their code and their lingo that what they're looking for in a way of stability. Will he work out? Is he fine? We're happy and satisfied with his background. But as for today, I'm not sure if this policy has changed.
Hmm. And what about when you have to get the physical test every 6 months, but there's no mental equivalent?
No, I've never experienced that. It's every 6 months. It's just a physiological exam.
Okay. Yeah. All right. And the other thing you were talking about, and first, what is the absolute required retirement age for a pilot? Has that gotten younger now?
No, this big breakthrough. It was 60 years old for many, many years. I'm sure a lot of people know that. President Bush signed into law just prior to his resignation that because of the work code, is that pilots were maybe being considered not having to exercise their full rights to continue work. The nature of the job is the only thing I could think of that required a pilot to retire at 60. But now, once that law has passed, many countries around the world have adopted beyond the 60 age. So there's really no definitive age anymore.
Oh.
So the only thing I've heard of in the way of restriction is that once the pilot, if he's still flying at 65, he cannot act as pilot in command, but he can still be a first officer.
A first officer. Interesting. Okay, so the other thing we were talking about are these, first of all, the simulator tests that you say were so grueling. Tell us about what they are, and you have to go through them constantly?
Yes, Bonnie. When a pilot is transitioning onto a brand new airplane, the required syllabus is that you integrate with your simulator during the practice or during your training. When it comes time, when you've reached the end of your sessions, then you have to do your we call them rides. Usually an FAA Czech airman would be present. Their company instructor will be there. You'll have about two or three officials in there, and we'll do an initial ride in the simulator. Once that's done, then the pilot, once he's successfully completes that, he will go on the actual aircraft and do what we call line training, line indoctrination. You'll actually be doing flights with your Czech captain on board with you. Because these simulators are so real, they have absolutely everything imaginable to make. It's the ultimate video game with motion. The only thing that was actually missing is to feel the pressurization.
Okay.
And beyond that, to maintain recurrent training, companies require that minimum every 6 months that the pilot candidates, as we're always referred to, will have to go back and spend, in our case, a minimum of 2 days of back-to-back four-hour flight simulator sessions with briefings and debriefings and written exams.
Every 6 months?
Every 6 months.
Wow. Pretty rigorous.
Well, and in our case as well, we have to do a minimum of one en route flight check, a series of flights with a Czech captain. And there's usually another day of what we call a safety briefing that we get together with the flight attendants for part of the day, and we actually do mock-up drills together.
So you say it's everything but the pressurization. So does that mean they put you in all sorts of circumstances? Like, I mean, could you be landing on an icy runway, or, I mean, do they simulate all sorts of conditions? Is that it?
Absolutely, yes. You're right. You're quite right about that. They do have everything. We have pretty well dial in any kind of weather situation that's required, because there's a syllabus that we follow. We have, they try and rotate it, so every 6 months you cover all the systems of the airplane. In 1 year, you'll cover everything. Weather-related, we can, in fact, take off pretty well blind in no visibility. We're examined and trained for that. For landings, we can have some severe weather. We can have rain, sleet, thunder. And yes, as you say, icy runways with variable wind that can be usually a crosswind or something that's challenges both the aircraft and the pilot.
Yeah. And the other thing you mentioned after the show was about these FAA spot checks. What are those? Do they go in plain clothes or something on the plane and ride on a flight, or doesn't work that way?
Well, I always wondered. I think they kind of float around the airports.
Oh, okay.
So you can get them at your first flight of the day, or if you're doing multiple legs, one can just, he'll come up to us either in briefing or at the gate, identify himself as the check airman, and he'll be conducting a routine flight observation for the day, whether it be one or two legs or three legs. And he rides in the observer seat, and usually they don't say anything, but they'll check our paperwork, they'll check our licensing for make sure that everything is current. They'll check our logbooks, they'll check if the aircraft is legal to fly, it's been maintained. So they're looking for a lot of things.
And do you think that those have increased since 9/11, or maybe there's no correlation?
I don't think that's increased, because it's always been around.
Okay.
They have absolute authority to come to board just about any flight, as long as we know who they are.
Right, right. Mm. We're speaking with retired airline captain Bruce Bornstein on All in a Day's Work, Part 2, Life of an Airline Pilot. And we're going to come back, take some emails, some calls. Please stay with us. Okay, welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman speaking with retired airline captain Bruce Bornstein. It isn't Groundhog Day. We're having a part two because there was so much demand and we didn't cover we covered so little the last time he was here in our All in a Day's Work series. So we're having him back and we are hoping you'll participate. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576. Email radio at WLRN.org. Tweet us at Topical Currents. Before we start with your taxiing on the runway, I just want to take Andre's call because he's been waiting and it's something we talked about a little. Andre in Coconut Grove, welcome to Topical Currents.
Hello, Bonnie. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
All right. The question I wanted to pose to the guest was regarding pay for burgeoning and new airline pilots, especially in the regionals. Some of them make very, very little money. You can make more working at a fast food restaurant than you could being a regional pilot sometimes. A lot of them live in, you know, houses together and grouped up together because they can't necessarily afford to live, we know, where they want to live and where they're based. So I just wanted to talk about this, you know, if you've seen any change or movement in the industry to help address that.
Hi, Andre. I was lucky in my case. I went directly into and I bypassed the feeders because there were really no feeders back in the early mid-70s. Yes, you are right. Most airlines now have major feeders, and it's a requirement that they start out there. I do know in my case that the pilots, we started out on what we call flat pay for a minimum of 1 year. I know that has been changed at the discretion of the airline. They can increase that to 2 years or beyond, along with probation. So as far as the carriers or the feeders go, it's never going to be quite the salary that one expects when you move up into what I call the majors. So it's a great correlation, if you want to think of it, between minor league baseball and major league, because there's a big salary change. So I hope that answers your question.
It does. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for calling. All right, so now let's get to the taxiing. All right, so we got to all the checks and stuff last time. You said that I believe there were many challenges to taxiing, so how do you navigate those taxiways?
Well, that's a great question, and it was probably one of my biggest fears and challenges, especially when I started out and even to my retirement. Taxiing is a challenge because even at your home airport, your home base, things change. If it's a good day, it's a nice weather, things go well, it's very easy to miss or not hear instructions given by our traffic controllers. There's many frequency changes before on the radio that I have to make before I actually get to the button of the runway to commence our takeoff.
What do you mean that there are a lot of frequency changes? You can't hear the air traffic controller, you're saying?
Oh, we do. In the old days, we just had to talk to usually one frequency, one ground controller, and then we're handed off to the control tower when we're at our takeoff point. Now we have what we call apron controllers. And depending on the airport, most major airports will have these assigned different frequencies because things are so busy now that we can talk to one or two apron controllers till we're handed off to the ground controller. So that's just the communication part.
Okay.
We rely, I haven't been part of the new technology where we have onboard libraries, where we have tremendous screens that actually have moving screens, much like your GPS in the car.
Okay, that's what I wondered, yeah.
Yeah, that's available now. Boeing's 777s have it. The new Airbus generation airplanes would have it, greatly enhancing our view. Our ability to navigate around the airport because in weather, at night, distractions, it's hard to read your charts when you have to fumble them in a little light holding it when I used to have to clip it onto the side of my window
right.
to try and find it. So it was.
So you'd actually have to look at it to navigate? I mean, a map? To.
It's a chart. There's several charts, but then it's also a visual aid that you have to look out the window because taxi lights are blue, and there's many different colors to identify where you're at. You would have amber, you would have red, and it's easy to slip up. There's other airplanes around you. There's when the weather's bad, we have some icing conditions, and especially when we're in foreign airports. When I say foreign, if I work in the States, and I go over to Asia.
Right.
The challenge could be even greater because I'm not there all the time. So I actually study the chart layout hours before I arrive, so I know where I'm going to exit as soon as the airplane stops its landing roll. This is what the fellas need to always keep in mind is that we're busy. There's live runways. We have to cross live runways, and we have to maintain sharp lookout. We have to use certain lights to identify ourselves till we get into what we may say the non-active area. So,
would you say that taxiing is maybe the most dangerous part of flying?
It's all part of the big safety goal. There have unfortunately been some catastrophic occurrences in the past. I don't want to refer to them, but it is clearly shown that one little mistake has wound up with a major calamity because there's been miscommunication, which is one of the biggest fears.
The communication.
So my situation, I feel that when I'm overwhelmed or there is a situation that I'm not happy with, and I know that to try and guess my way out of it, I prefer to stop the aircraft and put the parking brake on, and maybe some of the guys will think, well, what is he doing? He's slowing up the game here.
Right.
But I'd rather take my time and get things clear before I proceed.
So, did I miss anything on the taxiing, or did we cover everything?
Well, I think you got the highlights of the taxiing. Well, I wanted to add, just it's a little humorous, is that, say, one airport, it was Seoul's Incheon Airport, at least when I was there, as that when after we arrived and taxied off the live runway, we were greeted by a follow me truck. And it's just it's a vehicle with a big sign on the back with flashing lights. And it's such a great relief because he'll take you right to your parking spot.
Now, where was this?
Well, this was, in my case, I remember Seoul had this.
Oh, Seoul.
Seoul is Korea.
Korea. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I thought you said Seoul.
Some airports do that from time to time.
That would make it easier.
Very easy.
You know, I thought it was a silly question, but you mentioned about at night. And so is taxiing, takeoff, and landing really more difficult at night than, I mean, it sounds like it's obvious, but then it sounds like a silly question.
No, absolutely. You're right on the money there. I found probably even under the best of times and conditions is that in Tokyo, They have a very low tolerance for anything that goes out of their operating procedures. Sometimes if you miss an exit or you miss an entrance, it's not considered a big deal. You may have to just return and go back in the lineup. Certain local laws dictate that it's that strict that we, if there's three or four of us in the flight deck taxiing out, especially at night, is that we all in concurrence and agree we are where we're at, we know where we're going, and there's no question about it. So it's a challenge. I'm always relieved when I arrive where I'm supposed to be without incident.
That's good to know. Okay, we're going to move along to takeoff, but before we do, let's talk to John in Fort Lauderdale, who's been waiting. Hi, John.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, so my question is, actually, right now I'm currently a student in Fort Lauderdale, ATP. I think I have about 2 check rides left until I'm done as an instructor. And my ultimate goal is to go to airline. And what I've been hearing in the past year, especially since just before I started flight school, is that in the coming years or so, there's going to be an enormous pilot shortage, and that the growth rate for aviation is going to be, you know, it's going to be increasing in the coming years, I think in the next 20 years or so, especially in Asia. Now, this is, you know, it contradicts a little bit about what we see in the news, where airlines are going bankrupt, excuse me, and the overall quality of airlines is going down. My question was just, as from someone on the inside the industry already, the airline atmosphere, what do you think is going to be the future for new pilots now? Do you think it's going to be a more easy to become an airline captain in foreign markets, or do you think this pilot shortage business is actually, you know, it's correct, and that there will be an actual growth, or if it's just marketing for flight schools?
I've always heard too, pilot shortages, and when I started out, it was the military guys were due to retire within the 10-year window when I began. First of all, let me say and hope that training standards will never degrade, even if the demand meets the requirement to hire pilots. Now, as far as advancement goes, sure, it'd be great if one was able to go direct entry into the major carrier. If you can get on board, that's terrific. I know a lot of fellas are very frustrated because they've spent so many years in the feeders and feel that they're never going to get on, and if they do, they'll never make captain. I can't say economically how everybody operates and what their company procedures are. So with respect to that, looking at the other spectrum, what I find is that you mentioned that in Asia and other parts of the world, they have big demand for experienced airline pilots of all kinds, simply because their growth rates are exploding. So it's best, or sometimes some of the fellows in the airline will take a leave if you can, and they'll work on contract. That's a very popular thing to do. And they would take requirements probably not as demanding as, say, in North America or Europe. So it depends on the carrier. So a contract could be a very interesting way to go if you get to that point.
Cool. All right. Thanks very much.
Okay, right. John. Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
Well, we have to go to a break, so we're not taking off quite yet. But we do have an emailer I want to get to really quickly because I want to take off when we get back. Mary wants to know, she wants to go to Hawaii. However, the thought of flying straight over the ocean intimidates me. When you're over or near the continental U.S., you feel like if there was a problem, the plane could always land somewhere. What can your guests say to help lessen my fear of flying such a distance over water? Bruce?
That's a very good question, and I understand your concern completely. When twin-engine airplanes were introduced almost 20 years ago and actually licensed and approved to go long range, I'll refer to that as ETOPS, or EROPs, extended range operations, which means that the manufacturers, in particular the engine manufacturers, have to prove over a series of time that they can sustain level or close to level safe flight and make an alternate airport or an airport suitable for landing. And depending on what it is, we call it the 180-minute rule. It used to be the 90-minute rule. In other words, if you were to experience a problem with one of the engines on a two-engine airplane over the water, legally, we would have to be able to safely return to one of those suitable airports and able to land without an issue. And it really hasn't been much of an issue because as we speak, there's more and more reliability in the way of technical advancements with these power plants that are available today, especially in the introduction of the Boeing 787 Dreamliner. So not to worry.
Okay, Mary, not to worry. It's Topical Currents on WLRN, and we're visiting with retired airline captain Bruce Bornstein, all in a day's work. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with retired airline captain Bruce Bornstein. Part two, All in a Day's Work, our series, our new series, exploring many different occupations. If you want to speak to Bruce, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576. Email is radio@wlrn.org. Questions for a captain, a retired captain. Okay, takeoff. We made it. Can you take us through the process?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Once we're finally in, ready at what we call the button, where the taxiway meets the threshold of the runway, our checks have all been completed except the last few, which we keep what we call open until we are entering the live runway. The control tower are the only ones who can clear us into position and takeoff. Once we receive that, our final announcement is made for the cabin to secure for themselves to take their seats. Mm-hmm. And we'll have our final, we have lights that we have to make sure that they're all on. And when we do, or we are given the permission to take off, what happens is whoever's doing the flying, we'll just, for this sake, say the first officer will be doing this leg. We will have a definite command and say, I have control. Whoever the pilot is that's in control of the airplane, one of us has to announce, I have control or you have control.
Kind of like when a fly ball, where they have to call it.
Okay.
Didn't have that in mind. Okay, go on.
Okay. I have control, and he will line the airplane up, and he will advance the throttles to where they need to go in our settings. And once the airplane starts to move and pick up momentum, the other pilot will be scanning at all times. And we have such great reliability, which I can't really get into, but you can imagine just how sophisticated it is. It watches for problems for us that we don't even see.
You're talking about?
Oh, about a malfunction that could occur. And what it does is sequentially prioritizes them. So if it deems that it's not that important, it won't come up and alarm us.
Okay.
It won't enunciate. So it's actually inhibit system. As speed progresses, there's certain callouts made. When the final speed is reached for takeoff, in this case, the first officer will what we call rotate. If he's on an Airbus, he has a side stick, and much like video games, I'm sure lots of people know or have experience with side stick controllers. He will progressively put a back pressure on it and focus his eyes on our primary flight director, which will command the airplane to exactly where it should go. So usually about 15 degrees, we pitch the nose up. We look for what we call a positive rate. When the captain sees that, when he notices it, he calls a positive rate, and then the other pilot will say gear up, meaning that the landing gear has to be retracted.
What is speed is that when you reach that speed, you said? Is there a general speed?
There are. It all depends on the weight. It depends on the temperature. It depends on the wind. Depends on the runway.
Okay.
We enter all this data when we're at our pre-flight checklist, and it's actually computerized and spits out these speeds for us. We enter it on the computer, and it's actually read directly off our screen. The average speed would be if we're going overseas, we're heavy, it would be about 145 knots, and we always use knots, whereas that's when the nose we'd rotate and it would start to lift.
Is it more difficult when you're on a transatlantic flight and you have more fuel? Does that make the plane heavier and harder to take off?
Well, we certainly would carry more fuel in a domestic flight because there's reserves and legal reserves that we always have to keep in mind. We have to have a reserve, at least one airport, depending on our weather expected at destination. If it's really bad, we would have actually two if we can carry. And usually that's not a problem, two alternate airports for landing. But for weight, as far as weight is concerned, it's determined how much our burn rate would be. So we're within what we call the legal landing weight. And usually in transport aircraft, the heavier you are, the better it lands.
Oh.
Yeah. Because a lighter airplane will want to get into what we call ground effect, and it'll want to float, float, float. So a lot of pilots and a lot of people think you want to make the perfect landing, and the airplane will just eat up a lot of runway unnecessarily. But a heavier airplane just handles better.
Have you ever encountered birds when you're taking off?
Yes, not to the point where it would get into the news or anything. Occasional bird strikes will happen, and it's always within the takeoff landing scenario. Just something, usually sparrows or something, you know, very small, even a bunch of them, which is usually never an issue. But the airplane would have to get checked, and we have a bird strike checklist that the maintenance would have to perform, and we enter it into our logbooks.
I see. Okay, so then what so you're taking off, and then what are your responsibilities before you get to cruising altitude?
It's still very busy because most of our airports have very specific patterns that we have to fly.
Mm-hmm.
We're issued things like, say, for Tokyo, we're going to do, it's been a while, so I don't actually remember the name. So say we'll do a Kyoto 1 or we'll do something that's called, we'll number it. So say we're doing the Kyoto 1 for that particular runway. In our computers and on our screens, everything's laid out as to where our turns are going to be made, what our minimum altitudes are. Our speeds are dictated by law unless there's a local change in say the airport charts. But that will take us out of the terminal area. So their job is to get us out as quickly as possible because they don't want us there. They have so many behind us.
Right, right.
So once we're out, it usually about a half hour, we're at our first cruise altitude, and then we're on our way. So the workload usually starts to slow down a little bit.
When you get there.
When we get there.
And at that point, you just put it on automatic pilot?
I probably just missed that in most cases today, when we do our takeoff and the airplane is just airborne, less than 1,000 feet, most of us elect to put the autopilot on. Why? Because it does a better job. Why? Because we can focus and concentrate more on all the radio chatter, any changes that need to be made. And by the way, like many other industries and things that need to be changed. It's ever-changing and expected at all times, because what's charted or what is what we've planned can be changed at any moment or notice with air traffic control.
Including your route?
Very specifically our route. If they have something they can't handle, there's crossing traffic, somebody is coming in above us, they'll halt our altitude. They'll keep us low. We can actually see. They'll point out the airplane. We see it go directly above us.
Oh.
It looks perilously close.
Close.
Especially at night.
You know, I think you're scaring me, Bruce. Okay. We're talking with retired airline captain. Bruce, I wasn't afraid to fly, but Bruce Bornstein, All in a Day's Work and the Life of an Airline Captain. So stay with us. We're going to get to those calls as soon as we get back. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents, All in a Day's Work of an Airline Pilot, Part 2, with the captain, retired airline captain, Bruce Bornstein. And, well, we just got into cruising altitude, but before we get there, we're going to talk to Greg in Fort Lauderdale. Hi, Greg.
Yes, thank you for this topic. It's great.
Thank you.
I understand that the official language of air traffic control around the world is English. I've had an opportunity to listen to local air traffic control in different parts of the world, and I have a hard time understanding the accents, even though they are speaking English. And I was wondering whether he's experienced that and what they do about it, if anything.
Hi, Greg. You're absolutely right. English, I think I mentioned last week, mm-hmm. is the universal language of air traffic control and pilots. Where I feel I'm not going to say bad English, but the English, they do their best, but certain countries that we are dealing with are perhaps a little more difficult than some others, but the problem is enhanced with our fatigue. I find that if I was had a long flight and I'm landing in Frankfurt, I know it's busy, and I know these guys rattle off clearances. They can do 3 or 4 in 30 seconds, and you have to listen up very, very as accurate as you can, because they get a little short-tempered if we don't comply or we miss our calls. We put them out of sequence. So when that happens, I take advantage of all the crew members that are with me, not just one or two. If we have a relief pilot, we have an extra crew member that's part of our flight. It's good that we all have our ears on there, and one of us will usually understand it on the first time. Asia is particularly a challenge because they do their best, and I'm not shy. If I don't understand it, I ask to repeat it, even if it's numerous times. So I hope that answers your question.
Totally. May I ask another quick one?
Go ahead.
Another quick one.
We don't want to have part 3 next week, Greg. So
I'll be quick. I understand that the normal navigation in the United States, at least, is waypoint to waypoint. Are you starting to use GPS and be more freeform in the routing?
Well, GPS has been around for a long, long time now. A good over 20 years. In fact, in the 80s, when I was a second officer on the 747, we had the new inertial navigation systems that did not have flight management systems, which is basically a more enhanced system. So our computers now are data-based, meaning that they have canned and stored routes, and we can always intervene, and we can make our own, we can store a route, we can call up a route, and we can make any changes that are necessary with air traffic control. Or if we find that there's a lull in the action, in other words, we'd like to bypass our normal routing and go more direct, we request it, and if they grant it, then we can just do that. And yes, everything is a waypoint, but instead of numbers, we name them. But behind every name is a latitude and longitude.
Gotcha.
Okay, Greg, right. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for the show.
You know what, Bruce? When you were saying about someone has to call control of the plane, what is it that you say?
For whoever's designated in who's controlling the aircraft, you just simply say, "I have control."
And who designates that?
Usually the captain, if he feels there's any reason that he has to assume control because of a something that he's not happy with, or it's just something that we have to do operationally. Say in certain landings, we have many categories of landings where when we have absolutely zero visibility, it's a big deal because we have a lot of things working for us, and the captain's the only one who can conduct it. And interestingly enough, he's not allowed to fly it.
Really?
It's only the autopilot is allowed to fly it, and we just monitor.
When you have zero visibility?
Absolutely. And the airplane, if all goes well and everything sequentially does what it's supposed to do, we don't even see anything, basically, until we actually touch down. And at that point, the airplane will still be navigating and I won't say flying, but it's going to track itself right on the runway center line until we physically disconnect the autopilot. And then the whole taxi challenge starts up again.
Then we got the taxiing. Okay, well, we're going to get a little bit more to landing if we can. Mm-hmm. We may not get to landing today, but Adriel has been waiting and wants to ask about automation and drones. Okay, go ahead, Adriel.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, sure.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for the show. It's a wonderful show, and I really do appreciate anything that has to deal with aviation. I'm actually at an airport myself, and I'm a local seaplane pilot. But I want to glean a little bit more insight into the industry in the future. We're just talking about the automation and the zero-zero landing sequences that they have nowadays, or they have had for a number of years. Looking forward, do you see the route becoming more through automation to the point where we will simply have remote stations with pilots remotely monitoring several planes at one time, sort of like what we're doing militarily with the Predator drones over various conflict zones and so forth? Do you see that occurring in the future?
Am I understanding your question correctly, that would there be, say, pilotless aircraft in the future?
Yes, commercial-wise. My thought process is that I would assume that it would first be introduced and will automate cargo flights. Cargo doesn't complain or have funny feelings, right, or have fears of flying, whereas passengers will probably be a little apprehensive about that. But would do you see that being part of the future, total automation in the aircraft?
There's certainly always been lots of anticipation of taking technology to the point where it's into the stratosphere with having a pilotless airline or airplanes. That would certainly make the airlines happy if that could happen, because they drop a big salary right there and save. But for one reason, I can't see this really practically happening is every flight has its own characteristics, its own just what takes place in every flight is different from the next flight and the next flight, the one ahead and one behind. Contingencies cannot be handled. Even with automation, it could perform it, but it wouldn't know the when, why, how. So there's a big timing factor there. Machines have the great ability to assist us, and that's all I can see where it's at now. It helps relieve the workload. It does a fabulous job as it is today, and I can imagine tomorrow how much better it will be, but I cannot see any drones in the future, be it cargo, passenger, that could ever take effect or actually be in aviation.
Okay, Adriel?
Very good. Thanks again.
Okay. Thanks so much. All right. Well, we're in the air. There, you can change route in the air if you've lost time. Do you sometimes have to take another route? What else happens during mid-flight?
The best example I can use is overseas. When you're talking about a 15 or 16-hour duration, the dispatchers do their very best with our weather inputs and our winds. We're so accurate that we actually put our winds aloft, meaning We do step climbs as we burn off fuel. We're too heavy to go to our final cruise altitude. So we're constantly putting in new data to try and actually knock our time down a bit and obviously our lessen our fuel burn. We carry all this contingency fuel, but we do have a schedule in mind at all times. So when you're dealing with 400 people who may not, where we're going, be their final destination,
right,
we're very aware that we want to get them to the airport in time for their connection. So if we are happen to be running late due to we're held down at altitude, or we've got airplane ahead of us, or there's the winds that were unpredicted, we can have a look at that, and we'll talk about it with our dispatcher. We have that ability, and if it works out, we'll put the request in with the local air traffic control authority wherever we are at that point in time, and see if something better can be worked out. And we time to time this happens.
Would you believe that we didn't get to land?
They have to keep buying another ticket.
Oh, is that it? Well, retired Captain Bruce Bornstein, all in a day's work, the life of an airline pilot. We didn't get to so much more, and I want to talk about your personal life as a pilot and all that, but I don't know.
We tried to cover
as much as we could. We thank you so much for coming back.
Oh, thank you very much, Bon. It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Come fly with me. Let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay.
And that is our program for today. We thank you so much for spending your time with us. Sorry we didn't get to hear more. Our producers, Richard Ives, with technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. Our series, All in a Day's Work, is created and produced by Peter J. Meritz. We have free audio archives and downloads at our website, WLRN.org, and more information, links, and photos at the Topical Currents Facebook page. That's facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
Where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide, starry-eyed, once I get you up there.
Tomorrow's Topical Currents begins with prolific South Florida author Michael Largo. His latest book is The Big Bad Book of Botany. From absinthe to zubrowka, Largo shares his delight in the weird and fascinating world of plants. Also, Linda Gassenheimer considers the importance of bees and measures being taken to stem the tide of their declining populations. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a great one. I hope you get to land wherever you're going. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.
Fly with me. Let's fly, let's fly.